Things are going to start happening to me now.
You've done all the reading. You're a scholar. You're a professor. You've done all the reading. You've done the intellectual heavy lifting.
More or less, eat shit and die.
You wouldn't know a fact if it begged you all night long.
Want to, like, give the wrong impression, because I am very high.
F***ing ran up behind him with a hatchet. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah. Care. I'm a libertarian. What I'm getting is,
did you vote for Joe Jorgensen or Trump?
Who?
Joe Jorgensen. That was the perfect answer. Thank you.
And welcome everybody to the LPR Libertarian Podcast Review. This is Tyler Yonke, and we're talking about the fourth, final. Well, the third one with Pete Quiñones, but the third one with him. It's the fourth one in this segment, in this series, maybe fifth if you add the one I did with Jose. Dead Man's Party, Leo Frank. We're talking about this one with Pete. I just thought I'd do a quick intro and maybe some disclaimers here, especially with the shit kicking off in this Middle East and what this actually means. You may hear some things here that are a little bit provocative. You might even take them as anti-Semitic. That's not my intent. What this you need to understand is we're talking about this specific series, the specific issues that came out of there, the ADL that comes out of there with Leo Frank, and the problems with that into today. Right now, we're having the GOP, Nikki Haley as an example. You have lefties, righties all saying, if you say one bad thing about Israel, it is anti-Semitic. I think that is just ridiculous. And what you're, the point of a lot of the stuff that Pete and I talk about, especially at the end, is the power that the ADL and the Israeli lobby and some of the Jewish people themselves have put together of this, trying to shame you into basically non-person you, and then you can be criticized, you can be killed, you can be whatever. It's no different than the BLM stuff. If you didn't put up a black square on your Instagram during the BLM riots and protests, that you were then against black people. That's ridiculous. But the right is now taking that on. So it's perfectly fine to push back. I don't really have much issue at all. And Pete may be completely different. He would probably disagree with me in this, with Jewish people in general. I've just never had much of a problem. Matter of fact, I grew up more on this conservative side of believing all the Ben Shapiro stuff. And since then, I've taken into account some of the things Pete says, but I disagree with him on some of that as well. And the Martyr Made podcast and then some other documentaries I've really dug into to understand the Middle East process to better understand where the feelings are coming from. And what I've deduced is it's easy to now say this is a religious war and task everyone against each other. And to once again, if you can say someone is being anti-Semitic, if someone's a Nazi, now you don't need to listen to their point of view. So, you know, we go down this route. And once again, I just feel like a little declaration of my points on these things, and really the culmination and what you come out of with the power and the propaganda of the ADL of their beginnings is really about victimhood. And there's reasons to say that the Jewish people were victims at this time. I don't know that I'm not going to get into all that, but what happens with the ADL is you have one bad guy. And now you've got to protect Leo Frank. And now you've got to protect him somehow. You can't even let one bad person go. I don't understand. He's a piece of shit. The fact that they tied themselves to this guy is, to me, their problem. And now we're exposing it. And if they're going to then say, the ADL is going to now say, well, that's anti-Semitic. I'm sorry. You're going to have to look back all the pleadings, everything we've got here. It's a fast treasure trove of a lot of info. Now, let me see if I could put this up on the screen real quick here. Here's my Substack, substack.com, Tyler Yonke, or tyleryonke.com.substack. Either one of those, I think, will take you to the right spot. I have put all the links that I've, and it's just your starting point, books, documentaries, audio files. There's tons of them out there. The American Mercury, they went through and they have, it's like a website that was started by, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. but it doesn't matter. However, they've got a lot of stuff on there. They end up putting a lot of these books and a lot of these issues or pleadings and whatnot into audio form. So there's links to them to YouTube, where you can listen to a lot of that. That whole Nation of Islam book is on audio that they did as well. So if you don't want to get the book, it's in my pack over there. But if you don't want to get the book itself and you want to listen to it, you can do that. Once again, the starting links are all there. There's multiple websites. Go there and you can dive in for yourself and find everything else. If you have questions about this, send it to me. I think what we'll end up, this is the last one with Pete. And then I think I will do a complete kind of like overview and follow up if there's some other things here or some people have some questions. There you go. Four segments, three with Pete Quinones. I think it went really well. Give his show, obviously, a like and a follow. Mine as well. And share this out there with people. I'm putting it in a playlist. You'll be able to see it. By the way, confirmation, Tom Woods coming on the show in about a month. I must thank Pete Quinones for helping me set that up. Big, big thanks to him. So without further ado, we're going to do Dead Man's Party. Party for Leo Frank. I haven't listened to the lyrics of Dead Man's Party in a long time. Maybe it's grand, it's grandiose, or it's making a big deal out of the dead man. I don't know. Or are we just celebrating the dead man? Either way, part four of Tyler Yonke's segments, part three from Pete Quinones. Enjoy.
Hey, show. We're going to wrap this up now, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Pete. Nice to talk to you in a time of peace.
Yeah.
Oh.
Whoops.
People look back this at a few years and say, "Excuse me?
Yeah. What are they talking about? What was happening when they recorded this?" Right. So, basically, ended on the guilty verdict last time, and then the appeals. You talked about the appeals, and I guess the commutation of the death sentence comes first, but. Before we do that, probably getting into the level of, I mean, what the media did and the media blitz. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let me start. I found this quote. This guy, Leonard Dinnerstein, he was an author. He wrote a book about Leo Frank, and I think for his dissertation, and then he's updated a bunch of times. Now he's a scholar. But here I just thought this was, I found this last night and I just thought this was great. So this is how he acknowledges anti-Semitism. He said that in anti-Semitism in Atlanta, quote, was evident in the widespread acceptance of Negro Jim Conley's testimony. I mean, if that doesn't say it all, it's like, and then kind of where we're at today as well, which is you go against our narrative, no matter what it is, you can't actually have a principled disagreement. And this is a lesser man, this Negro. Therefore, since you accepted his testimony, we are then you're anti-Semitic. That's the whole process.
Well, something that we've definitely seen in the past week is that if you even mention, you know, you're like, oh wow, civilians died. I mean, that's friggin' horrible. Well, civilians are going to die on the other side as well. It's either 100% you are for Israel and you are for the Zionists, or you are against them. And we saw that when Tucker Carlson was interviewing Vivek, and Ben Shapiro did a completely insane rant commenting on it, where he made zero sense. I mean, there was no facts and logic in there at all. It was emotion and bloodlust. And yeah, so I think we know this, we can see this in our current day, that if you are not 100% behind Jews and or Zionists, you're anti-Semitic. And you know, I think a lot of people in the last few days have come to accept the fact that they're anti-Semitic.
Well, and I say that because that ties into kind of where the ADL is now and a lot of the stuff that we had with the press at the time. So it's just an important, and by the way, my journey from this, we don't need to get too personal into it, which is I've used to be more in the Ben Shapiro camp. You know, I'm not a Jewish person. I'm religious. You know, you think that the Christians have to support that kind of thing. And it was along the lines of, I remember telling someone how I didn't like Jimmy Carter. And I'm like, he's anti-Semitic because he wrote some things pro-Palestine. You know, that's kind of the cudgel that you use. And it shouldn't be done that way. Anyway, we can move on from that part.
Okay, good.
Okay, so let's talk about what we didn't really get into too much. We skirted around it a bunch, is the news and the way that the press really took this into account. Okay. And with that in mind, did they come into it right away? No, it took a little bit of time for some of these the northern Jewish families and stuff to really push into this. It started with Albert Lasker. Okay, Albert Lasker, actually, it's his father who, I did find this out yesterday. He was a Confederate himself, slave-owning family that they had down there. And I think he was from Texas originally. So this Albert Lasker is the head of Lord and Thomas. He's kind of like the unchallenged monarch of American consumer advertising, the founder of modern advertising. You think of all these things that happened. He was the man that really pushed this, you know, kind of a change in 1913 with some of that. So he comes into prominence there. His dad said, hey, you got to take a look at this. And so he starts to take interest. A lot of the press did come into it right near the trial. You know, William Randolph Hearst threw someone down there for his newspapers. And there is some reporting, you know, claims on some books and stuff that the news, the emphasis by the North changed the trial because they couldn't come out as anti-Black as they really wanted to do. You know, we've shown things here. They definitely were. So they said they curtailed that some. However, the Nation of Islam book really shows how much Lasker himself, you know, a man mostly of the South, although he lives now in Chicago, Adolf Ox, who was now running the New York Times, but he was actually a Southerner too. They had strong, strong feelings about slavery, the Black man. They weren't any better. So I don't know that necessarily played into it, but it drew some interest, and there still was a little bit in the North, some of this pretension that we're going to give Blacks at least their due. So they had to restrain that a little bit. Albert Lasker, he really pushes this. And the key for him, so they come in mostly after the trial, but the key for him was he had a ton of money. He put over $120,000 of his own money in there, 1913 dollars. So I think the book, they translated that to like 2.9 in 2016. That's still a lot of money even for today, of his personal money. But the big thing he had was connections, and then he had pull. So think of the guy that's the advertiser, and you're now running a newspaper. And how does your newspaper thrive on advertising? If this guy wants one direction for you to go, you might be going that way. You might start changing your attitude or your editorials, the way your news stories are, simply by the fact that you're going to get better advertising through Albert Lasker. So that was one big thing he had. What was interesting, and I'll get right to this on him. So he said, let me give you this quote here. He in his biography, revealed that upon his first personal meeting with Frank, Leo Frank, he perceived him as, quote, a pervert and a disgusting individual, so much that he even hoped that he managed that if Frank managed to get free, the latter would quickly perish in some accident. Furthermore, in his private correspondence, he freely admitted that a large fraction of the massive funding that he and his numerous and other wealthy Jews from across the country were providing had been spent on perjured testimony, and there was also strong hints that he explored bribing various judges. Given these facts, Lasker and Frank's other major backers were clearly guilty of serious felonies and could have received lengthy prison terms for their illegal conduct. So once again, we talked about the money. That was the big thing from the trial till the appeals, was going through with this Burns investigator trying to change the testimony a lot. Okay, so Albert Lasker, he then brings in Louis Marshall. Louis Marshall was the American Jewish Committee president. He was an attorney. He was really well connected. Some say he might have been the most highest praised or thought of prominent, I guess would be the word, Jewish man in the country at the time. He had backdoor dealings with SCOTUS. He knew Woodrow Wilson. He became the lead attorney for the Leo Frank after the trial and through all the stuff. So his connections were huge as well. Along with Lasker, they then recruited Adolf Ox. Now, Adolf Ox at the time, he was from the South, but he was now the owner of the New York Times. this guy, he liked to put down the blacks as well. But he really got involved in this thing. And I just wonder what's interesting in here. Once again, we'll say another thing. He had a quote here. Lasker convinced of his innocence. No, at no point was I convinced of his innocence. He also said on the death of Frank, I'm sure that it was a relief to Mr. Ox, who Frank lynched, and out of the way. I have felt for some time that he secretly despised Frank. That's what one person said of Albert Ox after he was done. So these guys did not like him. They said, and I have some other quotes we could kind of go through as to what their whole feeling was. They also then brought in Jacob Schiff. Jacob Schiff was a Wall Street financier at the time. Shocker. Well,
I know who Jacob Schiff is.
Okay. What do you know about him?
He financed the Bolshevik Revolution.
Okay. Well,
in Russia. I mean, to the tune of $200 million. Do you know how much? Do you know how much that was in early 1900s money?
I can't even imagine. How many billion? Trillion?
2 billion.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, that's how much. That's how much he wanted to get revenge upon the Russians for the Pale of Settlement.
Wow. Well, what's interesting, his connection, he started and he was a financier. He was helping this as well. But his thing actually is he had connections with Georgia and Slayton, the governor Slayton. And he actually, there was a, to help with the fund some cotton industries and through the state there, he got, I think it was $139 million loan for the state of Georgia. This is right at the time of the commutation. Because remember, when Judge Slayton commutes, and we'll get the spoiler, when he commutes Leo Frank's sentence, he then is out of office in like a few weeks, if even mm-hmm. that long. So he then, Jacob Schiff, tries to, Marshall, the attorney, tries to have Slayton, because Slayton was an attorney as well, we'll get to his dealings, wanted to have him nominated for SCOTUS. And then actually William Randolph Hearst had even written some things and wanted Slayton to be the VP choice for Woodrow Wilson. So, William Randolph Hearst, we're not even really getting to get into much of him other than he had a bunch of connections, a bunch of newspapers, and he was pushing the same thing. Once again, from advertising, I don't even know much. I didn't dig into Hearst. He wasn't as interesting to me on some of these. Some celebrities that were Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Jane Addams, they all were pushing for Leo Frank's innocence as we...
Henry Ford?
That's what I got out of one clip. So perhaps that's true.
Interesting. The man who wrote The International Jew.
maybe at some time later, he's like, you know what? He wasn't... Because when did he write that? Because it was later, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember. But go on. Keep going.
All right. Like I said, this changed some strategy as far as the thing goes. But one of the best things that comes out of this, and once again, like I've said, if you are you're interested in this at all, or someone's pushing you, the best sources are the original sources. And one of the guys with some of the best original sources were this guy, Thomas E. Watson. He was a populist at the time. He was an attorney. I think he was even a congressman. He ended up starting his own, his own newsletter, and he started pushing back on the trial. What is interesting, when they always talk about anti-Semitism, they bring up Tom Watson because he kind of turned that way. But he was mostly anti-black and very anti-Catholic, extremely anti-Catholic. So when we talked earlier about the cabbage and Mary Fagan, you know, being a Catholic girl, this is a guy that's like, I'm going with him. Plus, if you do check out his writings, and they're all there, you can still find them. And I'll, at the end, maybe I'll talk about some of the sources we have, because there's some great sources where they put these on audio. So all his writings are still out there. He did not start writing about the trial until after it was over. So the anti-Semitism, let's say there was some anti-Semitism from 1913 after the trial to the appeal. Okay, maybe. But does that matter? Did that really? It doesn't matter for the appeals, because the appeals were he couldn't get due process because of the anti-Semitism in the South. So we're just wiping that out. Tom Watson didn't start his fervor. And one of his most famous things is called him the pervert Jew. That's what he started to call Leo Frank, which is what Albert Ox thought of him, which is what Adolf Ox and Lasker thought of him as well. So yep. Is it out of the, no, it's, by the way, if you look at his writings, Tom Watson, He's very good, fun to read. I'm not saying I agree with everything. I'm just saying he's a great writer. But he wrote in defense of the Jews many times before the whole trial. So he got, and we'll tie this in here because Tom Watson is a very strong individual. The North comes down, and even Albert Ochs and Laskers talked about later on where they overplayed their hand. We came in, we tried to destroy Georgia in a sense, and then what happened? And they didn't take this guy seriously. Tom Watson happened, and he just eviscerates them point by point, recapping the trial. He knows all the legal jargon, and he knows all the laws from down there. He talks about one of them, venue. They could have easily, because they're like, look, we're in Atlanta. We didn't get a fair trial. Okay, you know what you could have done? You could have asked for a change of venue. You never did that. And he breaks down how they could have done that and likelihood of actually winning on that and had your trial somewhere other than Atlanta. But they were cocky, and they thought that they would get Leo because we have a black man that's going to testify. So Tom Watson happens. The New York Times can't even compete with him. He's just, he destroys them. He knows way too much, and he takes them on the facts. So that to me is in his reasoning why he turns on the Jewish people. What, by the way, he had defended them in court. He is an attorney. They advertised in his magazine. None of this anti-Jewish sentiment came about during the trial. Once again, it's just not evident in any of the writings. So that just doesn't happen. Anyway, so that's kind of the news story around there as far as the newspaper's influence. One other thing, I'd say it real quick here. 7 months before he's killed, the New York Times writes an article about they expect him to be lynched at some point, or they're saying that's going to happen, and they call this group the Knights. We've heard, it's an anonymous source, the Knights of Mary Fagan. And it comes to that's our one, by the way, that's one of the best conspiracy of this, and we'll get to that in the end. Okay. Anything you wanted to say about the news stuff?
No, let's get into Slayton and what most likely caused him to commute the death sentence.
Right. So one of the first things I did, by the way, when I started reading all this, because it's 28 pages, the easiest thing to do to kind of get a breadth of this is you read Governor Slayton's commutation report. It breaks down the facts. It says everything. And I came from that. And my first thought was, Jim Connolly is just a disgusting person. He's not that great. And then you go through all the facts of it and you kind of backtrack and you go, oh, okay, you know what? He was a product of his times. I don't think he was all that bad. But Governor Slayton did commute the sentence, and he conducted like a 4 or 5 day inquiry. He had people testify again. Dorsey, the prosecutor, was like, look, this is BS. We've already done this. But Slayton wanted to do this. He said it was the right thing to do. And in the end, he decided to commute the sentence from life in prison to life in prison from hanging. And we'll get to his connections. But here's what he found, though, still in his commutation. There was no error of law. There was sufficient evidence to sustain the verdict. He felt like an imprisonment represented justice, also reserved for convicted murderers. As far as the anti-Semitic mob, he said no such attack was made and none was contemplated. He said Jews were revered and contributed greatly to the development of slavery-dependent Jim Crow state. Okay, you got to do this, because now you look at the ADL and there, and we'll get to that. He made his commutation based on what he considered new evidence, much of which was produced by the disgraced detective William J. Burns, who we've talked about, Ochs, Lasker, all said they perjured people up and down the state of Georgia trying to get this thing. So that was his. Of Connolly, the black guy, he said the evidence shows that Connolly was as depraved and lecherous a Negro as ever lived in Georgia. There you go. By the way, I don't know if we finished this, which is Jim Connolly does get convicted for like an accessory after the fact, spends a year in jail for his crime, and dies, ripe old age, I think in the 1940s, 1960s, something like that. Never hit the news wires again for crimes, which, if he was this disgusting sexual pervert, by the way, that movie I saw in the 1988 one, he's like Gollum in a cell, and this black lady's there, and he's almost like jerking off because he's just so, they show him as just this lascivious, oversexed person. It's wild.
Yeah, I'm not shocked. I mean, who made that? Hollywood?
Right. Yeah, Bob Lemon. Lennon. Bob Lemon. He was the old guy, the dirty, grumpy old man. Is that his name? Is that his name?
Jack Lemon.
Jack Lemon, sorry. He played Slayton. And by the way, there's an old movie in the 60s where Walter Matthau plays Slayton. So those guys team up to play the same guy, and then later on they're grumpy old men.
The original, well, and weren't they the original Odd Couple too, I think?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. So they just had, once again, yes, they were.
Yeah, and I think Charles Dutton actually played.
Charles E. Dutton was the black guy. It's all wild.
Right. All right, so commutation of the death sentence, and
by the way, I just remembered something.
Sure.
Albert Ox and some of these, they decide to run a portrayal of the crimes at one point. So they have actors and they do all this stuff. And I always find this funny because if you've ever seen Birth of a Nation, they like to do this too, which is you can't use a black man to portray a black man. You use a white person in blackface. And it's it looks so creepy from now. But anyway, he did that as well. But yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So commutes a death sentence, and then some people start moving, going, just making decisions.
Yeah. So Slayton actually, he takes off, and they move the prison for where Leo Frank is from one to another. By the way, if you read all the stuff about the discussion at this point, Leo Frank is really loving his notoriety. He's starting to have people come visit him at the prison. He talks about how wonderful his conditions are there. People are sending him money, and he's loving life the way it is. They move. He gets slashed in the neck at one point. Someone tries to kill him. They save his life, and then a few days or a week or so later, a lynch mob breaks into prison. This is A-team or something. Breaks into prison, takes him out to, I think it was in Milledgeville, and they take him to Marietta, where Mary Fagan was born, and they string him up, and they lynch him, basically. So,
And there's actually a picture out there.
Yeah. Yeah, there is.
We won't... We won't be providing that or anything.
No, they put a nice cloth over his face, though, so you can't really tell. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, why don't you talk about the fact that it does eventually, I mean, he does get, I mean, this is jumping forward. He does get pardoned.
Yeah, maybe we need to finish off Slayton, because there is one connection we didn't talk about there. Slayton's
Slayton World Tour?
Well, yeah, you might know a little bit more about that than me, actually. What I found was, okay, he's governor from 1911 to 1915. You know, the murder happens in 1913, so there's, a two-year span that he of elections. He just gets elected governor right before the murder or around there, and he had merged, because he's an attorney, he had merged law firms with Luther Rosser, who was the defense attorney for Leo Frank, okay? They had just merged. So he can't practice law, so he's not doing that. But let me tell you, after he commutes sentence and he's done, he goes back and works for the law firm. Like I said, Jacob Schiff tried to get him either put on SCOTUS. William Ramner first tried to put him on as a vice president. Schiff's letters to Slayton indicated that he would give him this cotton loan at 100, like I said, like I think it was $139 million loan. But firstly, he asked him, how do you feel about Leo Frank's innocence? And by the way, this money is, he hinted it was conditional on that. So anyway, there's good connection that Slayton was perhaps bought off, or he thought it was in his best interest to do this. Plus, as you can see, what he thought about Jim Connolly, you just believe the quote unquote, I have to do it for you, Pete, white guy in this one. What do you know about, and by the way, Leo Frank's murdered, and Jim Connolly is actually in California at the time, and he hears the news. What do you know about him?
From what I heard, that Slayton immediately, once that happens and once the news of the lynching comes out, he immediately runs to New York. Mm. And he runs to the people who, you know, what they assume is the people who paid him to do this. and there's no chance. No one's going to run him for SCOTUS now. No one's going to run him for vice president now. So they just hand him a bunch of cash, and he goes and he just basically tours the world for a little while.
Yeah, which sounds about right.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know how he ended up. I didn't look into that, but you know, basically, you know, he committed a crime. He committed a crime, quote unquote, and then he ran. And his the people he did a favor for paid him handsomely, and he decided to see the world.
Yeah, it did come across that as soon as, like I said, Marshall, the main attorney for Frank after the fact, the real connected guy, when Jacob Schiff said, "Hey, what about him for SCOTUS?" He's like, "Yeah, he's not a smart guy. I wouldn't put him up there for any reason." So, yeah, there we go. So,
yep. So he, all right, go ahead, go.
So what happens, and maybe, do you want to talk about the lynching and the conspiracy, or do we save that, Pete? We tease the folks here.
No, go ahead and do it.
Okay. So I mentioned, this is what's great about the NOI book here, about the secret literature of blacks and Jews. It's from a different perspective than perhaps we have, but it's one that's really interesting because they are, they're coming at it from an aggrieved perspective as well. You know, and talk about all the lynchings that are happening there. Slayton only is concerned, or these people only get riled up because one Jewish man gets lynched, yet Slayton never commuted the sentences for a bunch of others. By the way, it was they at one point went through page after page of just how the due process for blacks was at the time. They had transcripts from a court hearing, and it's literally, you know, Mr. What's his name? You know, you step up. Did you take this lady's purse? No. 30 days. The next guy, did you do it? No. 30 days. And then one guy's like, "Hey, I said I didn't." He goes, 60 days. And then he goes, "What? I can't." And it's 90 days. Fine. 2 years. And that's the kind of, it was like within, you know, 5 minutes, you're jailing, you know, the 15 different black guys. So that's the way this was. Okay. So the book indicates that there was such disgust for Leo Frank, and he started to have talking. He started to have interviews. They said, "No, you've got to stop this." Once again, they thought he was this complete pervert. "I didn't like him from the moment I saw him." These are legit quotes that I never thought he was legally guilty or innocent. I think there's a, which is a weird phrase to use, to the point where they felt, and I did read that one quote where they felt that him being dead was actually more of a benefit than not, because the more he talks, the more interviews, now you commuted his sentence, you're not going to hang him. Fine. We got that. Cause they actually thought we'd commute it. Maybe we'd get some sort of other release, but the lynching is a better deal. Now, the New York Times makes this thing about this, these Knights of Mary Fagan. And if you, by the way, if you look up the KKK, the second wave of the KKK, they always say, you know, Simmons started on the, what was the mountain up there? Stone Mountain, out there in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the Knights of Mary Fagan. But the Knights of Mary Fagan never were, what you can tell, were actually a group. Like I said, New York Times mentioned them 7 weeks before. There was one other magazine, it was the Israelite, that had mentioned him. Great name. But that was actually the brother-in-law of Adolf Ox. So there's a connection there. This group then lynches him. They never said that there were any, Simmons never said, I think that's his name, never said that there was any connection to Knights of Mary Fagan. There was never a group associated with the Knights of Mary Fagan. So the Nation of Islam thing is, this could have been your first false flag. We're basically, did they do the murder? Did they, you know, try to have this guy lynched, maybe take him out themselves? Possibly. I think that's a great conspiracy to come away with. Either way, it was a benefit for the ADL and everyone else involved. Actually, probably on both sides to have this. The interesting part of the Knights of Mary Fagan is you mentioned the picture of Leo Frank being hung. Guys are sticking their head to try to get in the picture. They're not hiding their faces. They would take pride in this, and that never happened. And by the way, Simmons also, when they started the KKK at that point, wrote proudly of the Jew, or nice of the Jews. He didn't have an issue with them. So once again, we just want to emphasize this KKK formation out of Mary Fagan, anti-Semitism, the connections are not there.
Well, the, I guess one of the arguments is, and E. Michael Jones talks about this, is there's no real consciousness for anti-Semitism in the South at the time, but it really seems like because of everything that happened with this trial, everything surrounding it, the press, the commutation, the just everything, that this was really like the genesis of, hey, these people have a lot of power. These people seem to stick together and they want to be above the law. Maybe this is a group we need to look at.
The KKK or the Jewish community.
I'm thinking the Southerners. Oh. The Southerners in general. The consciousness. This helps to build the consciousness of the idea that Jews are just in it for themselves and they'll do anything to protect their own people. And
very, look, you read the Tom Watson stuff. I mean, he was very put aback by the Northern aggression in words and the way that this all went down. Very much could be. I mean, but once again, The Birth of a Nation comes out. I just want to emphasize this. The Birth of a Nation comes out in 1915. And that's right around the lynching. Actually, it was after. It made a killing. It made a killing in Georgia. I think that I mentioned that MGM basically was founded off the funds that were created from that movie. There were Jewish, brothers that had the movie in the South. They said at what is it in 7,000 Jewish people in Georgia around the time of the trial. And there was a study done that it went from 4,000 in 1910 to 12,000 in 1937. So you're looking at 300 Jews a year coming into the area. They weren't slowing themselves down. But the sentiment could very well have been, once again, the way that the press really tried to push this as, once again, we're backwards place, letting the black guy talk, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so I know this is a little bit forward now. Let's get to the pardon.
So to even set up the pardon, the ADL forms 1913. Once again, this Livingston guy started it in Chicago, but he had $200 in his office, and the real power was down there in Georgia. So it comes out of the B'nai B'rith situation. And why did I just lose my train of thought?
You were talking about you said the ADL. We're talking about the pardon.
Oh,
we got to start with the ADL.
You know, luckily that doesn't happen to me in court. But if it does, I'll call up Pete. So the ADL is pushing the pardon for quite some time. The Georgia Board of Pardons is like, no, this isn't happening. We've already had everything. You know, good luck. However, in the 80s, suddenly there comes out. I think it was 83. Comes out this guy, Alonzo Mann. Now, Alonzo Mann, if you remember way back from episode one, he was a witness in the trial. He's a 13-year-old boy that testifies that he's in the facility, leaves that day at 11:30, said there were some people there, couldn't recognize Mary Fagan if he saw her in front of him. He'd just started in 1st of April. It only worked two Saturdays, so he may or may not have seen Connolly. Suddenly in his 80s, he has a recollection that everything's changed and that Jim Connolly, he had actually seen him there carrying Mary Fagan over his shoulder and ran into the boy and said, hey, if you say anything, I'm going to kill you. So what's this kid do? He goes home, tells his parents, and they're like, let's see how things play out. That black man seemed really dangerous. So he goes and testifies at the trial, not much in there. And like I said, 83 some years later, now he's got a change of his story. Once again, the best part about, look, there's several books that perpetuate myths over the years. One of them talks about kill the Jew or we'll kill you. That was a phrase that happened. The first writing that ever came out in was like 1965. So you go back to all the contemporaneous stuff, it's never there. He repeats that. Oh, there was a guy when he went to the courthouse, had a gun. Now let's think back here. Who are you more afraid of? Are you really afraid of Jim Connolly, who gets arrested on May 8th and is incarcerated all throughout the trial, spends a year in jail after the fact? Are you really worried he's going to kill you and your family in the South, in Georgia? It doesn't make any sense. So with this, this new revelation, the whole story comes about. The Tennessean writes a big article about it. Now the ADL is on the path. They send it back over to the Board of Pardons to do this. And they have Mr. Mann there with him to basically show off to the board about how this guy, it's now he's I think he's senile, honestly, because when you read the transcript of that, his attorney is saying, hey, this happened. And he's like, I don't, what? And I mean, he's not there. And the attorney's trying to give the answers. They turn him down. However, they come back a few years later and the Board of Pardons, I think, is just gets so inundated with the pressure that they actually, they do pardon him. But this is important because, let me see if I could get to the actual pardon statement here. Let's go. I have it in my book here. So, cause it's, what's important is everyone, if you even watch on the ADL the website, and they have a little thing about the ADL, the formation, the 100-year thing that they had, it talks about now he's been pardoned. I think this is, oh, here we go. This is what they said. Without attempting to address the question of guilt or innocence, and in recognition of the state's failure to protect the person of Leo M. Frank and thereby preserve his opportunity to continued legal appeal of his conviction, and in recognition of the state's failure to bring his killers to justice, and as an effort to heal old wounds, the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, in compliance with its constitutional and statutory authority, hereby grants Leo M. Frank a pardon. Now, they had denied it previously because he's not a live person. There's really nothing to pardon. And I think that's the statute. So it almost seems like illegally they didn't do the right thing. But it's important to note there, they emphasized, started out with, we're not talking about his guilt. This is simply, we couldn't protect him. You took him out of the facility and you lynched him. Therefore, we're doing a posthumous pardon. That's it.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's like the way they parade Biden around now, who's a complete, you know, whose mind is completely gone. They bring this guy in, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh, it took him what, 70 years to grow the nuts to say this. You know, it's like now it's okay to say it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, you would think he would have, you know, after the Civil Rights Act, oh, now I'm protected. I mean, it's just. It's just ridiculous. Did we talk about hoaxes?
We can talk about that. One is the bite marks, or the kill the Jews or we'll kill you. That was kind of the first one.
Right.
To start with that, since I mentioned it. The only way that they can trace any connection to that is evidently Luther Rosser, or the defense attorney, at one point got a phone call preparing for trial, and someone, you know, said, kill the Jew or we'll kill you on the phone. And he's like, he didn't do anything about it. He didn't really care, because who cares? So no one ever said anything about that. And it never, and I don't mean it that way, Pete, but that's fine.
No, it's fine. But it's funny though.
No, but I mean, once again, we have to, this is what's crazy. And I think this is the problem with, like, even the ADL. They want to go back in time with today's standards to some extent, but not really, because if we did that back then, I mean, once again, it's a Jewish man in Atlanta. He's going to be thought of as upper class compared to anybody else. So is that really, anyway, the point was that was never said. You can't find it anywhere except for, you know, after the fact, when people in the 60s are starting to write books about that. Another one was bite marks. I think someone had commented about, was there ever bite marks? This is another crazy thing where, look, all the original materials out there, the coroner, when they testified, you know, from the autopsy, there was a lot they can actually do, especially science in 1913, the best that they could muster up. But they didn't have x-ray technology, Pete. And people have now said, oh, you look at the pictures, there was actually bite marks. And no, there's no bite marks. It looks like the pro-Frank people trying to do something. I don't even really know where that goes, because they take teeth impressions. Once again, if these are there, you could have done it. By the way, there was a bloody fingerprint on one of the back doors, but they could have asked Conley to take a fingerprint and match it, but they didn't. Interesting. Hmm. Yeah. There's, I don't know if any other hoaxes, big ones.
Hoaxes. Foes. Well, I mean, I guess really the only thing to wrap up with is the fact that this was all used to empower and create an organization nowadays that has international political power.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, is it the first of its kind like that in the United States? I think I'm trying to think. I mean, it would definitely be the most powerful. There may have been Jewish organizations before that. I mean, B'nai B'rith, but that's really just a secret society.
Well, the AJC was kind of, it was that's the Marshall had that. It's the American Jewish Council.
American Jewish Congress.
Yeah, something like, is that what it is? But they were actually specifically tasked with trying to assimilate rich German Jews into the U.S. That was kind of their thing, and that's where he had a lot of his money. But yeah, I mean, I take it. It's kind of like the NAACP, the SLP, or SPLC, ACLU, even, or the Rainbow Push Coalition. These are kind of all.
Do you know what all those have in common? do you know who started all of those?
Leo Frank. I don't know. No, but
people of people who call themselves a certain background.
Yeah. I know it's fascinating. This is what I found off the ADL's website, which is that there's some videos they have, and one of them is this is what they claim, that they're fighting against the one they found this out. This is why they were created. And I could play this video. They might try to strike you, but it says fighting against the one form of prejudice could not succeed without battling all forms of prejudice. Now, that's what they said it stemmed from in 1913. Does that sound like they were worried about Jim Connolly's rights and the prejudice to him? Absolutely not. So, you know, if this video is like a minute 40 or so, I don't want to play it. But if I did, we could just walk through all the false narratives that have been created because we know all the facts now. And that's what's amazing about it. They say, oh, and he was pardoned. Well, he wasn't really. I mean, these are important little distinctions to know. So, by the way, did you get a chance? I watched this documentary called Defamation. Did you happen to?
I haven't watched. No, you shared it with me. I haven't had a chance to watch it.
It's really hard to find, and I finally found it, and I ripped a copy. So if anybody needs it, we can probably post it up. And it's a Jewish Russian from Israel. He decides to, hey, let's find out this whole thing about the ADL and stuff. It starts out, he's talking to his mom, and she kind of rags on Israel and some other things. He follows a bunch of kids from Israel that go over to Germany to, like, you know, Holocaust memorial type of stuff. And it's fear porn the entire time. And I think that's what I found out about. And then he goes to the ADL with Abe Foxman, and he goes, I want to follow an incident that you have. Oh, okay, let's find one. And so they're on there. Oh yeah, this person, they had a, someone found a Nazi flag in their yard. So these are the things they're tracking. So at some point, and then he talked to Norman Finkelstein, which was interesting as well. He talked to a more Orthodox Jew in New York. And the interesting part, especially the Orthodox guy, was more along the lines of this Zionism stuff. It's what it does is it actually perpetuates anti-Semitism. And then you go and you see, what's your definition of anti-Semitism? And it is so broad. Pete, it reminded me of the good old days of the Jesse Jackson, the Rainbow Push Coalition, where someone, I went to the University of Colorado. I'm out there, Coach McCartney, he's done. So they hire Rick Neuheisel. He comes in, he's not Bob Simmons, who was supposed to take over as a black man. So Jesse Jackson comes out there and he just tells you how horrible you are. And he tries to, you know, basically, I'll be good for you news-wise if you pay me off. And that's kind of what the whole thing is. So it's a very similar feel that it has to that.
Well, the ADL does that too when what's that basketball player?
Kyrie Irving. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When he part of his apology was writing a he had to write a check to the ADL.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, and that's pretty much what we knew Jesse Jackson was doing. He would go in and he would basically say, look into a corporation and be like, you don't have enough black representation here. Either get black representation or you can write us a check.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what, I mean, where'd they learn that from? Where do you learn that from?
So,
I mean, it's.
What I found with the big connection, like you watch that documentary and you think about the Leo Frank thing, what came out of it, which was Leo Frank, which is there is a lot for us to fear. Now, one of the incidences that the ADL showed was this girl that said, oh, woke up. This is just a recent video I saw. She wakes up, her friend sends her a text, and there on the chalkboard in the chemistry lab was a swastika. She was just in fear, Pete. She was in fear. Now, I'm not a Jew, but things have happened to me, and I'm sorry. I don't have the fear of every little thing at high school like that, and most people don't. But when these kids went and they visited Auschwitz, one girl is on camera talking to the guy, and she's like, "Oh, I was there this morning. This guy was over there, and he started yelling Nazi at me." And he goes, "I was there. He didn't." And she goes, "Yeah, I know." So, okay, that's a weird aspect for a teenage girl to do, but they instill the fear of everything around the corner is going to be harmful, and it's not healthy. It reminds me, you know, it was interesting, you talk about the Jesse Jackson, and kind of the same idea of the blacks come out of the South, and there is a lot of fear. They're getting lynched a lot, but at some point, where are we going from here, right? Are we going to allow this to envelop our lives, and is it a healthy situation? I'm sorry to preach on this, but this is kind of what you see now, and this what we have of criticism has to be, and if you criticize in the wrong way, you're going to be labeled. And the label itself is the way that they can try to, censor you.
Right. Yeah, it was, it really seems like they have their own history and they create it. I don't know if you've seen the Ben Shapiro history of Israel that's going around, where he just basically gives the Israeli side on everything. You know, no mention of anything, any kind of, no mention of the King David Hotel bombing, no of Irgun, no mention of Lehi, no mention of the Levant affair, no mention of the USS Liberty, no mention of basically anything, no mention of, he talks about how they acquired the Golan Heights, in the 67. And it's like, you realize that that's like against international law. You can't gain land by war anymore. And
I don't know. That's not my thing. I'm right. Learning more, but Dave Smith did break that down, and I thought it was very good. And he said one thing that I thought was actually great, which I've actually had a judge tell my client, which is, you know, you come here to swear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The omissions are just as bad. And that's what Ben failed to do, because you can't have this honest discussion. And by the way, it's so weird to see a guy in Congress who's a Christian wearing an IDF uniform. You know, I'm German. I'd be, you know, that would not happen.
I don't know how, you know, it's a lot of what you've seen this week is, how they basically want you to believe that Israelis are just good. They never do anything wrong. There are no settlements, no settlers. Settlers never kill kids just for fun, which they do. And kill Palestinian kids just for fun, they do. It's not human shields. It's not them throwing stones and hiding. No, it's they just, the settlers are the most radical of the of these groups, and of the Israelis. And you don't get that. And, you know, lies by omission, if you're just going to give your side of the story, I'm sorry, you've lost the right to be trusted. And as far as I've never trusted Ben Shapiro, because for somebody who basically has made his fortune attacking identity politics, there's no bigger identity politics issue than Zionism. I mean, Zionism is a supremacy religion. And I was talking to a friend of mine who grew up in a very strict Jewish family. She got out. She's one of the smartest people I know. She's one of the most anti-Zionist people you will ever meet in your life. And, you know, I told her, I said, if we could just break people's minds from this Zionism, it would be, it would be great. And she said, you're still going to have to deal with the fact that Judaism, just Judaism, regular Judaism, is a supremacist religion. And as long as you have a group that has power, that has wealth, that believes that they're supreme to everyone else, you have a real problem. you have a real problem.
You mentioned something that triggered me there, or not, or made me think of something actually, not trigger. You triggered a thought. It used to be a good
thing. I triggered you.
It used to be a good thing, which is I've heard actually Ben, and I've tried to do this myself, which is, you know, arguing politics. Ben Shapiro has said he tries not to argue them from a religious perspective. Okay, let's talk about abortion or whatever you want to talk about. And cause it doesn't, it immediately alienates some people. Yet, is there anything about this this current conflict that is not based in his religious perspective? So he can't argue it from there. So there's been some really good coming to Jesus moments for me, at least with him, of like, yeah, you're just, I there's a lot of people out there right now.
There was a time when I would listen to him every once in a while, 2017, 2018, you know, when he was doing a lot of the takedowns of the growing woke at the time. And I remember him once saying, he said, I don't even consider people to be a Jew who were born into a Jewish family. You're not Jewish unless you practice the faith. And he doesn't believe that. He doesn't believe that because there is Zionism is not, these aren't religious people. Most of them are atheists. They will be honest with you about that. They pay very, very little lip service to the Old Testament. They talk about the Talmud thing. And, you know, that's what they learn in yeshiva. That's what they learn in Hebrew school. And I mean, he's been caught in so many, if not in so much inconsistency, that he can't be taken seriously. He can't be taken seriously anymore. And with this whole thing, since this thing started, you just get to see how much of an emotional child he really is. Because he's basically just throwing fits.
He had some tweet today. The last bit of it. He talks about assurance by all the right people that Jews ought not to defend themselves. And I just replied, like, Jews or Israel? What do you? Because that to me is part of the problem here. You know, America First suddenly turned into America First in line behind Ukraine and Israel. It's a weird concept for me, coming from like pretty conservative upbringing, to suddenly seeing this. I don't know if the eyes are opened more, but it's a fascinating few years for me.
All right, well, I really appreciate this was fun, and also to get it to hear it from somebody who knows their way around a courtroom and had the mispleasure of being in law school.
And, for sure.
I'm sure there was a lot of good you took out of law school, but I'm sure there was a lot of wasted time there too, just like any other school.
Like I said, at least my law school, they tell you, we want you to try to think like an attorney. And for me, that was helpful. So yeah, I really appreciate this. Look, what you can take away from this is, if someone's bringing this Leo Frank thing up, now you at least have parts of this. You know, like I said, when I first read the commutation, I'm like, oh, maybe this guy's in. And then you go through it, and it's a slam dunk case that people have had to glom onto. And once again, why is this guy the person? Well, I think we've talked about it, and it's to create. They got caught up with themselves. They pushed this thing too hard, and now they have to stick with it, which is it's fear porn. And you don't have to go down that route. You could easily say Leo Frank was a pervert Jew.
the fellows who went down there to defend him.
Yeah.
Said, you know, he's a pervert. And maybe they did. Let's leave that alone.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tyler. Thanks. I appreciate it.
But she's back.
Chick-fil-A is completely overrated. It's not that good. I prefer Zaxby's. I prefer Popeyes.
Takes a tough man to make a tender forecast, Nick. I guess that's me. Keep fucking that chicken.
Should I vote for Dick Cheney on the Libertarian Party? Do I have an obligation to vote for Dick Cheney?
I would say so.
Yes.
Did it work for those people?
No. It never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us.
That one dude was like, not a podcast, I can't find it anywhere, I don't have video. Oh yeah, Peter Janke. Yeah.
Yeah, I blocked him.
I'll do it. If he unblocks me, I'll
he'll buy your shirt if you unblock him, Bert.
He's a wigger.
Yeah, nothing cooler than so a 49-year-old wigger. Like, yeah,
I just started live streaming. Cut me some slack. I'm pretty high tech for a boomer. But anyways,
boomer.